Hello and welcome to Power Problems, a podcast from the Cato Institute, where we take a skeptical take on U.S. foreign policy and discuss some of today's big questions in international security with guests from across the political spectrum. I'm Trevor Thrall, and subbing in for Emma Ashford one more time while she's out on maternity leave is John Glazer. Hi, John.
Hi, Trevor.
To many of us, the fact that the Trump administration and Congress managed to find time to nail down the U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade deal and a phase one deal with China was a little surprising, but it seems like a good time to talk about what these agreements mean, both from an economic perspective as well as a broader foreign policy perspective. And here to help us break it down is Dan Eikenson, director of the Herbert Stiefel Center for Trade Policy Studies here at Cato. Welcome, sir.
Thank you, Trevor and John.
Good to have you on the show. So let's just jump in and we'll, you know, tack back and forth between agreements as the, you know, feeling strikes. But let's start with USMCA. Can I call it that? Because I just love that. NAFTA was okay, but USMCA is a superior acronym.
Absolutely.
So let's talk smack about USMCA. How are you liking it?
Well, NAFTA was easier to pronounce because it had free trade in it. USMCA has no mention of free or trade, and there's a reason for that. It is really the first U.S. trade agreement that has no new trade liberalization. Just like the NAFTA, almost all goods trade between the three countries will remain duty-free. There were some provisions that modernized the agreement. In 1994, when NAFTA went into effect, the internet didn't really exist. Digital commerce wasn't a thing. And so we didn't have rules that would restrain governments from taxing digital transactions, forcing localization of data storage and things like that. So in that sense, it modernized the agreement. There are a couple of small details that sort of bring it up to snuff in terms of where we are globally with the other agreements. But by and large, and the reason that this agreement won the support of Democrats is that it's an agreement that doesn't liberalize trade. It restricts trade. The objective of this agreement was to compel U.S. companies to continue investing in the United States, to deter them from investing in Mexico, to deter them from importing from Mexico. So there are a lot of new provisions built into this that were on the Christmas list of the AFL-CIO for a very long time. So, and unfortunately, the Congress seems, the House seems willing to pass this thing as early as tomorrow. The Senate will have to wait a little bit, but typically Republicans would push back when you think of the old paradigm of anti-trade Democrats, pro-trade Republicans. That doesn't exist anymore. This is Trump's Republican Party. The GOP Senate is going to fall in line behind him. So the concessions that were made, the concessions that Republicans stood to defend, the issues that they stood to defend in the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiation have fallen by the wayside, and they're not pushing back at all. They want to get this deal done. And I think it will pass and become law. You know, it won't be that dramatically impeding, I think, but it certainly makes it easier for U.S. labor unions to push grudges, to push assertions that there are violations in certain factories. And what that does is it probably will deter investment in those factories. The rules of origin are also very onerous, raises the cost of complying to have duty-free access to the market. So, we'll see what happens from this. I would not call it trade liberalization. In fact, we haven't had a trade agreement worked out since the George W. Bush administration.
You know, it's Trump, you know, reminds me more of a 1980 Democrat than a Republican of any era. But I guess, you know, the new, you know, order of battle is that there are no free traders in D.C. anymore. It's depressing.
I guess the question is, though, will that have a lasting impact on the Republican Party, or do you think that to some extent they'll kind of snap back if Trump has one term, they'll start to find their free trade gusto again?
Their bona fides, yeah. If they ever had them. I don't know. I mean, the name to many is sullied, and I was hopeful of the idea that somebody would start to appeal to the center in the sense that labor is opposed to trade liberalization, the economic nationalists are opposed to trade liberalization. But what about the business community? What about, you know, the broader, you know, centrist concerns in the United States that see trade as beneficial, not from a personal liberty perspective like we do, but because, you know, why have taxes? But the Democrats didn't make a play for the center. They stayed. They wanted to out protectionism Trump. And I think the presidential candidates are all in that boat. And I hope that the next administration or the one after that will recognize the benefits that the TPP actually provided relative to this. It's basically the same terms, except it's with 9 other countries. I'm talking about $7.5 trillion more in GDP, many more people involved, and it does have some, I think, beneficial foreign policy objectives checked off there as well.
Yes.
So you mentioned TPP, and that makes me think of China. I think the other, outside of this hemisphere, the other big trade deal that the president wants to get is one with China. But before we get into the details of that, just broadly, what is the nature of the threat to national security from trade with China?
Trade with China, I don't think, presents much of a threat. I think the concern that has materialized and for which there is, fairly broad bipartisan concern is that the United States and China are in this race for technological preeminence. And China has been engaged in a variety of practices that many believe are unfair or predatory, forcing technology transfer, stealing intellectual property, cyber intrusions, and investing heavily, subsidizing very heavily technology companies and innovation. This has been building for a number of years. I think had Hillary Clinton won the presidency, she would be trying to do something about it as well. During the Obama administration, I know the intelligence community and the security community was gearing up for ways to sort of limit Chinese access to U.S. technology by impeding or scrutinizing very closely potential acquisitions and exports. And Hillary Clinton probably wanted to bring a case to the World Trade Organization with our trading partners who have the same concerns about Chinese sort of techno-mercantilism. But Trump comes in and just conflates all of the issues: bilateral trade deficits, currency, access to the Chinese market, which has been, pretty good for the most part. And so the U.S. launches this case under Section 301 of the Trade Act of 1974, which gives the president the authority to levy tariffs in response to unfair practices abroad. The problem with all of that is that we sort of agreed when we joined the World Trade Organization in 1995 that we wouldn't be judge, jury, and executioner. We would find these problems, perhaps, and then bring them to the WTO for adjudication. But Trump acted unilaterally, and he has conflated the issues. I think the trade-related issues are not that significant, but even if the Chinese ultimately are to agree to all of the terms that the Trump administration has been pushing, we still have the fact that we are in this race for technological preeminence, where innovating and where there are a lot of first mover advantages to discovering commercial innovations. And so I think it's going to be hard to compel the Chinese to agree to not try to leapfrog us, and it's going to be hard to compel the United States to not try to kneecap the Chinese. So we're going to have to think of this in terms of some sort of a treaty negotiation, like an arms treaty or something, rather than a trade agreement. And in fact, this turned into a trade agreement. This phase one trade agreement compels China to do all sorts of things that have nothing to do with the original complaint. It just kind of morphed into this big thing. And anyway, I think it's a good thing that they reached this agreement. Whether it holds or not remains to be seen, but at least it curtails escalation of the tariff war in the short term.
I want to talk more about the devils and the details there on the China deal in a second, but I just want to step back for a minute because I'm a skeptic on this question of the race for technological supremacy on sort of, I think, multiple grounds. First, the idea that a country has to be number one in any given technology to be fat, rich, and happy, it seems to me patently false. Ask Switzerland and Scandinavia how it feels to not be number one. Pretty damn good, evidently. Happy, rich, doing great. they benefit from the fact that other people innovate. They do a good job educating and taking advantage, it seems to me, of what other countries are doing, but they're not pushing the boundaries of most sciences and so on. So I don't really see why you have to be number one. China hasn't been number one, and they seem to be doing really, really well. So I don't really buy it just from that point of view. The second idea is this notion that somehow if China manages to leapfrog us in, oh, I don't know, CRISPR technology or artificial intelligence, that somehow this is America caught with its pants down and we're going to be at the mercy of a coercing superpower bully. But unless their new invention magically means that nuclear weapons no longer work, I really don't see where the fire is there. If the final piece of it then is, okay, well, economically, we'd be better off if we were number one at everything. And, you know, maybe, but like, if are we going to become China in order to compete with China? Just like, that seems like, so what is there? What part of that argument do you actually buy is what I'm asking, Dan.
Yeah, so I agree with you that we don't need to be so concerned about everything and that being number two or number three is not necessarily a bad thing. But the fact is that the United States has been the global hegemon for at least 80 years. And so we feel this challenge in a certain way. And I think we're handicapped by the fact that we have been distracted for two decades in these senseless wars in the Middle East and Afghanistan. We pivot back to look at China, and the reaction is overwhelmingly negative. Like, oh, we need to do something about this. It's a very easy thing to demagogue. I've been doing trade policy for a long time, and I thought I had a pretty good handle on the U.S.-China relationship from the economic perspective. Nowadays, you need to be a security expert, a technology expert, an intelligence expert, a foreign policy expert. And it turns out that as we consult the people on the security who have security expertise, they're very, very hawkish. We on the trade side are saying, can't we just improve the rules and continue to engage? No, there's a real problem. And the problem is exacerbated by the fact that there's fairly broad bipartisan support for this perspective, and it's an easy thing to demagogue, and it's also easy because of the nature of the particular regime in Beijing, which is a little different than what Americans were sort of promised when we were started to engage with China. These guys are surveilling their own people; they're exporting surveillance technology. Is that what it means to be at the technological fore? They're running concentration camps, they're persecuting people, and they have a president for life. So it doesn't take much analysis to just point in sort of caricature form to these developments, and it scares Americans. And I think the last Pew survey that I saw from a couple of months ago shows a continuing decline in the way Americans perceive not just the Chinese government, but the Chinese, something like a 60% unfavorable rating. And so We need to inject an overload of facts into this discussion. And I think protecting national security is an important, if not the most important, objective of government. But if we give them too broad a mandate and we don't define it well and don't identify the scalpels in our toolbox, then we're going to overshoot and we're going to create problems that didn't exist.
So when I first read about this phase one trade deal with China that was recently announced, I sort of wrote it off as empty before even looking at the details because the timing seemed rather suspicious to me. I think Trump did not, I think he expected to make more progress towards the deal that he actually wants by this point, and he's got to run a reelection campaign. And so he wanted this kind of short-term deal that didn't really meet any of his objectives. But so. First of all, do you think that's true? And then secondly, maybe you can flesh out some of the details for us.
Yeah, sure. Yes. I mean, I think Trump has learned that trade wars are not good or easy to win. And I think there was a time frame by which he needed to reach a deal in order to start pivoting to the election. And I think, frankly and unfortunately, he has a case to make now. I think it's good that the likelihood of escalation is now very limited, at least between now and the election. What happened with this phase one deal is that new tariffs that were scheduled to go into effect on about $160 billion worth of goods have been canceled. An increase in tariffs on $250 billion of goods from 25% to 30% has been terminated, so it's still at 25%. And then there's $110 billion worth of goods where the tariffs went from 15% to 7.5%. So we still have tariffs on more than half of the goods that we're importing from China. So if that's your big concern, and it is a concern, then you're not satisfied with this deal. But I would say, look, at least we don't have to worry about tariffs on all imports from China now. At least it gives us a little bit of certainty, even though it's not a better certainty than we had. On other things, the Chinese have agreed to purchase an increase of $200 billion of U.S. goods and services over the next 2 years from a baseline of 2017. So we sold about $185 billion worth of goods and services to China in 2017. So it's supposed to go up by over 100% over the course of 2 years, which is about a 45% increase, annual increase, which to most of us seems impossible. Where is the demand going to come from? Are U.S. exporters going to just ramp up prices dramatically to meet that? And if a lot of these purchases are in the agricultural sector, at whose expense does it come? Brazil's, Canada's, our other trading partners, they're going to be upset about it. And their businesses and their consumers are going to have fewer dollars to buy our exports with. So we may export more to China, but we'll end up exporting less elsewhere. And, you know, there could be a case brought to the WTO complaints. And I think China does not want to violate the WTO. Right now, the United States has launched its assault on the WTO. It's kind of assumed this role of international scofflaw in that regard. And China wants to play its cards right to say, hey, we're upholding this system. And so they want to play by the rules. So anyway,
it's almost like our entire approach does violence to basic economics.
This the assumptions at the core of the Trump administration's policies are just absurd. They don't understand why we trade. We trade so that we can specialize. We specialize so we can produce more. We produce more so we can consume and save more. They seem to think it's a zero-sum game. But just one last point on that. We have been arguing for years that trade is mutually beneficial, and you know, it's since 1776 that's been pretty firm. But the problem is that's being thrown back in our face now. It's like, well, if it's mutually beneficial, should we be engaging in trade with a regime that is committed to ideals that we disagree with? And we used to say, well, you know, trade benefits the Chinese people. It gives them a power source to challenge the authorities after the economic liberties, the civil and political liberties will come. I'm not sure that that's materialized to our liking in China yet. So we have to think more carefully about this but recognize that in addition to the sticks, there are lots of carrots that we can choose from.
Yeah. So a few months ago, a big buzzword in town was decoupling. And this idea that if, you know, you get too far down the road trade warring with China, that you're going to end up doing kind of permanent damage to the U.S.-Chinese economic relationship, sort of thereby like permanently really depressing, you know, size and growth opportunities for both countries, but then, of course, for the rest of the world. But that talk seems to have died down a little bit as this deal starts to emerge. What's your take on where we're at with this debate?
Yeah, I think a lot of people are turned off by the discussion because it goes sort of hand in hand with this Cold War metaphor. You know, when you talk about, oh, the United States and China are going to descend into a Cold War, people start getting, you know, this imagery of nuclear missiles and warhead buildup. And I think the Cold War metaphor is apt when it comes to the United States and China trying to win the hearts and minds of other countries and doing favors for them or threatening to punish them the way the United States and Soviet Union did. And I think that is still possible. The phase one deal does nothing, I think, to sort of nip in the bud concerns about decoupling. I think the Chinese have started thinking about alternative supply chains for their technology machine. They're very reliant on U.S. semiconductors. Now they're subsidizing indigenous innovation in semiconductor production. They are concerned about the leverage the United States has over the global financial system, as you know, most transactions in the world are conducted in dollars, and Americans are in charge of the system that clears that. You know, that's how we're punishing the Iranians with the or extraterritorially anybody that wants to do business with the Iranians. The Chinese see that, and I think that they're looking to explore new architecture in the financial world to have more transactions done in yuan, and to work with other countries who want to sort of circumvent these this U.S. leverage. So, you know, I think that we're not going to be able to put the toothpaste back in the tube. That's not necessarily a bad thing if all countries are thinking about ways to diversify against risk. It, you know, it could lead to a better outcome, but I think in the short run, the disruptions will be pretty costly, and the gyrations could lead to alliances that we didn't expect to exist, and to outcomes that could, you know, hamstring us for a long time.
Right. Speaking of that, tell us a little bit about what the heck the U.S.'s position on the WTO is, because this is a head scratcher for me. We built it, we loved it, and now we hate it.
Yeah.
I don't. What? You know?
Yeah. This is an issue near and dear to the heart of the Center for Trade Policy Studies here. You know, we have a couple of people working with us who've worked at the WTO, and you know, the WTO. Well. Those of us at Cato and around the world believe in free trade, but we also believe in the rule of law. And I think the trading system works better when there are rules. And since the end of the Second World War, the creation of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade in 1947, which you know, demonstrated that countries' economic benefits can be secured simultaneously, and that trade is good to reduce tensions among nations, evolved into this World Trade Organization, where there was adjudication of disputes. And I think Robert Lighthizer, the USTR, has a bad taste in his mouth with respect to the WTO, because he's a trade lawyer, a former representative of steel interests, and the U.S. trade remedy laws like anti-dumping and countervailing duty laws, which the United States runs in a way that violates the anti-dumping provisions of the anti-dumping agreement, the countervailing duty agreement. And he's unhappy. He thinks that there's been overreach from the WTO, from the appellate body, and thinks that the United States should have the sovereignty to sort of do what it wants. And this stems from this view that the United States is this benevolent giant that emerged after the Second World War. We provided funding for rebuilding Europe under the Marshall Plan, a nuclear umbrella that, you know, reduced defense expenditures for all these countries so they could build up their social welfare systems and rebuild industry to compete with us. And wow, we did all these things when we could have subjugated these people and you know, been like previous hegemons, you know, and just ruled the way we wanted to. As though there were no benefits to the United States in doing that, as though resisting Soviet expansionism was or rebuilding Europe weren't goals that were in our interests. Now they're thinking those rules have hamstrung us, and we're the world's largest economy. We depend less on trade than the rest of the world. We're going to start throwing our weight around, and so that is the impetus for the assault on the WTO's appellate body. I would say that the administration has raised some legitimate concerns. The WTO has not been perfect. It doesn't deserve to be bulldozed, but it could use some reforms. And so they've shown a spotlight on some of the issues where reform is going to be needed. Whether or not the United States is going to commit to that remains to be seen. So just today we had a kind of a new development. So the appellate body is no longer functioning. As of December 10th, there's only one judge, one member of the appellate body. There's supposed to be a stable of seven. You need a quorum of three to adjudicate any of these matters. There's only one. So a panel report came out that found against the United States, and the United States decided to appeal. So it's appealed to an appellate body that doesn't exist. And so it's, you know, into the void right now, and we'll see what this brings and what kind of resolutions pop up. But whether or not the United States wants to support the WTO will become more clear over the next year and into the next administration if there's a new president. Congress has not been very outspoken about protecting and preserving the WTO until last week. There were some members of the Ways and Means Committee who expressed their support and hopes that the United States would return to supporting the WTO at some point.
I'm kind of curious to step back from the politics of the day and just ask you really broadly, if you're the trade representative, What ideally would be your general approach on trade? Is it as simple as we maintain a preference for lowering our own tariffs and potentially incentivizing others to do so? I mean, how do you describe your ideal trade policy?
Well, it's funny because if you're a free trader like I am, you believe that your barriers are impediments to your own economy. And so you'd want to get rid of all your trade barriers. Well, U.S. tariffs on goods are pretty low, an average of about 2% or so. Well, that's, you know, pre-trade war. They're a little slightly higher now. But where we've not focused at all is on services. Americans consume far more services than goods. I think in 2017, about 55% of U.S. Of the goods consumed by Americans were imported. But we consume twice as many services, something like $9 trillion worth of services, but only $550 billion of it was imported, something like 5 or 6%. That's because we have barriers to competition in transportation, in legal services, in healthcare, in education. We need to open that up. So if I were the trade representative, again, I have to take one step back. We have trade representatives and we have trade negotiations. For what reason? I mean, it's a system that we call sort of mercantilist reciprocity. You know, it assumes that import barriers are negotiating chits and assets, and will only get rid of them if others do the same. When in fact, it doesn't really have that value at all. We should just do this by ourselves unilaterally. But since there's not much of an appetite for that, and if I were to hew to this mercantilist model of mercantilist reciprocity, I would focus on services liberalization and opening our markets. Certainly, U.S. services providers would benefit from that as well, because in many areas, the world's best in many industries. So I would focus on that. This administration is focusing on what they perceive to be the ills of trade, that it's a zero-sum game, that we have a trade deficit, that means we're losing because the foreigners cheat, and we have to do something about that. And that's bad medicine.
So if we're looking ahead a little bit, like I'm not going to bet any money on who the next president is. Tried that trick a few years ago. Did not work. Yeah.
So, we're all out of the business now.
Yep, permanently out of that business. But I guess I don't see any defenders of free trade on the left at the moment, though I'm not sure that they are worse than Trump. Do you sense changes coming? I mean, we're just going to keep going down the road we're going if Trump is elected again, I guess. Does he have anything else up his sleeve? And what do you sense from the Democrats? Do they have anything up their sleeve that's different from what we're seeing?
So I think the Trump plan is to continue to negotiate bilaterally with countries. Maybe the UK is next, or the Philippines, the EU perhaps, that would be a bigger thing, or Switzerland perhaps. I think this administration wants to use the USMCA as a model for trade agreements going forward. And I don't think that's the right model to use. But they want to have trade agreements that have sunset provisions in them so that the outcomes can be reviewed on an annual or a biannual basis, and so we can measure how much larger the trade deficit has grown. And if it's grown, then we have to tweak the terms so that we can achieve balanced trade. So it's lunacy. It is policy that is predicated on fallacy that we need to get away from as quickly as possible. I think if any of the Democrats running were to win the presidency, they would maintain the focus on protecting labor. They would continue to insist on provisions ostensibly protect the environment. But they would heed to the reality that the objective of trade liberalization, or the objective of trade agreements, is to increase trade, to increase exports and imports, and to increase inward investment and outward investment. And when you see that happen as a result of a trade agreement, that's a sign of success. It's not what the balances are. And so anyway, there's nobody who is politically well-connected or that I see as a possible presidential candidate or leader in the Congress who really believes in free trade in the ascendancy right now. So,
isn't part of the trouble is this political conundrum where actually it seems like both parties in some sense are responding to constituent concerns, the trade-related constituent concerns. And so for people that want freer trade, that's kind of a problem you have to fix somehow. I mean, is it a matter of public education? Is it a matter of finding ways to satiate the suffering and concerns of those particular constituents? Is it a matter of just ignoring? How do you get around this?
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I mean, I think part of what explains Trump's rise is sort of a cavalier attitude that the business community and the internationalists among us have had about globalization. That, hey, it's a good thing. It reduces barriers. It raises all boats. That there hasn't been enough emphasis on those who are adversely affected in the short run. And that's one of the reasons that Trump came into office, and he's trying to pay attention to the people that he thinks have been left behind. One of the problems that we have in our system is that we have, along with trade liberalization, we've usually passed legislation that changes what's called trade adjustment assistance that started in 1962 with Kennedy and the Trade Expansion Act, which treats people who lose their jobs because of imports or outsourcing differently than people who lose their jobs because of other reasons, you know, domestic changes, technology changes. The fact is, so few job losses are attributable to imports and outsourcing. Far more are attributable to technology changes and technology gains. And so if we're going to do something about those left behind, and I think we should think about that. I don't know the best way to do it. We should not treat the causes of job loss any differently and just have some broader approach to this, because every time we talk about trade in the Congress and trade agreements, we say, well, what are we going to do about those who are hurt by this? It gives trade a bad name, and it just reinforces that negative perception, and it doesn't make a lot of sense. Driverless technology is something that we're told is just around the corner. You know, we have over 1 million truck drivers in America, and if we have driverless trucks, they're going to lose their jobs, and there's going to be a massive reduction in the need for those kinds of workers. So that's not trade, that's technology. What do we do about that?
Yeah. I think one of the things that's, we bemoan here at Cato a lot the fact that there's a bipartisan orthodoxy on issue X or issue Y. But sometimes if it's the right orthodoxy, you like it. And in this case, we, I think, benefited for several decades from the bipartisan elite orthodoxy around the, positive benefits of free trade. But that has clearly started to break down. And whether it's because people aren't taking econ in college anymore in the Ivy Leagues, I don't know. But one of the things that seems clear to me is that the politics of it have really shifted.
Yeah.
And so one of the disturbing things that you hear like Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders talking about is the idea that inequality in America is now an argument against free trade, because globalization has only benefited the top 1% or whatever the notion. And it's just like, wait a minute, can we just stop and do some math, please? Because that's not how it works.
No.
And yet it sounds, it's truthy, yeah, to borrow a phrase, right? Yeah. It sounds right.
Right.
And so people are now pissed. Once again, they're going to break the windows at Starbucks thinking that's the problem somehow.
Yeah.
And I just don't know how you undo the, John, that was your question. How do you undo the politics that connect wrongly inequality and globalization?
Yeah.
It's just, I don't know. That's a sticky one.
It's a tough row to hoe. But the fact is, and Elizabeth Warren says this all the time, that trade only benefits the rich and trade agreements only benefit big corporations. It's the exact opposite. You know, if you look at our trade barriers, our tariffs, around 2% on average, we have tariff peaks on things like clothing, footwear, food, and we have trade remedy orders on housing. So we have trade remedy orders on things like lumber, cement, steel, flooring, appliances, nails, paint, cabinetry. All of these products, food, clothing, and shelter, are made more expensive because of our tariff policy. Meanwhile, trade barriers are a much bigger hurdle for smaller companies, companies that are challenging the incumbents who are resting on their laurels. The big companies say, yeah, trade liberalization is good, a trade deal would be good, but if they don't get it, it's not the end of the day for them. You know, it's not the end of the world for them. These smaller companies need this kind of access more than the larger companies. The other thing is people think of trade as a competition between us and them, and between two national monoliths, as though there's one manufacturing producer interest in the United States and one manufacturing producer interest in China, and we have to win. Well, when we impose barriers to protect that big, you know, national monolith, we're hurting the downstream companies that actually rely on the products that they produce and that we import. So it's too hard to explain, perhaps, for politicians. I remember Obama and Romney, instead of explaining the benefits of outsourcing during the debates, you know, two cycles ago, just pointed the finger at each other as to who was the bigger outsourcer. Oh, well, you're worse than I am. Rather than explaining it, it's, I guess their political handlers tell them, don't even get into it. So,
well, and you just on that very point, my father happens to be a doctor and in radiology, and the rest of the world outsources its radiology services to the United States. I think the United States is a bigger benefiter, like dollar-wise, of outsourcing from other countries than we pay other. I mean, if we stopped outsourcing, we would lose money. I mean, that would be silly. Why would you do this? But anyway, yeah. So in other words, we're in a tangled knot. Can you share some good news? Is there some good news on the horizon that we, just to leave listeners with a pep in their walk?
Don't be afraid to give an honest answer to that question.
If it's no, it's no, it's all right. But,
you know, when Trump was elected, I said that he was going to be the best salesman for free trade since Adam Smith, because he was going to give protectionism a really bad name. And, you know, we have seen people like Joe Stiglitz, Nobel laureate, who actually is a devout protectionist, start to change his perspectives a little bit. Not as many people want to be associated with the protectionism that Trump has given such a bad name. So I think it's a good thing that, you know, I've been here for 19 years, and the past 3 years, trade has been topical, and now I'm invited to dinner parties, and people never wanted to talk to me before because they didn't care about my issue. but now that it's so topical, maybe it's getting newer creative minds thinking about this and better ways to message this, and maybe we'll come out of this in better shape than we are now.
I love it. A positive prediction for the future. Dan, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Great talking to you. Thanks to our producers, Cecil Sherman and Luis Omada Abrigo, and to everyone for listening. To continue the conversation, as usual, our Twitter handle is @PowerProblems. And if you like the show, please leave us a good review on iTunes or wherever you find your podcasts.